It's The Takeaway for Tuesday, September 10th. I'm Tanzina Vega. A public dispute between the Trump administration and meteorologists leaves scientists feeling threatened.
What's happening at NOAA right now is reflective of a broader basis of questioning scientific reality and the value of science.
We'll talk about what this latest political rift means for scientific research under the Trump administration. And a digital privacy law is set to take effect in California next year, but tech companies are lobbying for an overhaul.
What's happening at the 11th hour are industries are seeking exemptions or clarifications to ensure that they can continue to operate status quo.
Plus, we'll look at the global issue of food waste and what's being done at the state and federal level in the United States to reduce the problem. But first, the White House versus the science community. As Hurricane Dorian barreled toward the United States last week, millions of Americans were looking to the federal government for life-saving information. And then, President Trump tweeted that the storm would hit Alabama. Just a few minutes later, the National Weather Service in Birmingham, Alabama, tweeted that the storm would not be hitting the state. And what should have been a straightforward clarification turned into a week of confusion. The president held a news conference with a seemingly doctored weather map, and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration posted a press release supporting the president's incorrect map. And now the agency's chief scientist is investigating whether or not this response by NOAA violated the agency's policies. Now, the latest, the New York Times reported that Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, threatened to fire top NOAA employees for contradicting the president, even though, again, the president was providing incorrect information about the threat of Hurricane Dorian. The Takeaway spoke with Richard Spinrad, the former chief scientist of NOAA under President Obama, and here's what he told us about what's currently happening at the agency.
This looks to be a pretty serious threat on the scientific integrity of those publicly supported scientists. That oven by itself is problematic. So in sum, what's happening at NOAA right now is reflective of a broader basis of questioning scientific reality and the value of science.
But beyond a case of political infighting, this story tells us a lot about the relationship between the Trump administration and the scientific community and what it means for scientists and climate-specific research going forward. For more on this, I'm joined by Michael Oppenheimer, director at the Center for Policy Research on Energy and the Environment at Princeton University. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
And also with us is Michael Halpern, deputy director of the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Thank you for joining us.
It's great to be with you, Tanzina.
And in a rare turn of events, we have two Michaels on the show today, so I'll be referring to you both by your first and last so no one gets confused, including me. Michael Halpern, let's start with you. What do you make of the reports that Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross threatened to fire top NOAA officials over the tweet from the Birmingham office that contradicted President Trump?
Well, it really is remarkable. I mean, science is often a political football. Everyone wants science to be on their side, but what's rare here is people being threatened for giving a weather forecast because the president won't admit that he made a mistake. We need to be able to hear directly from scientists who work for the National Weather Service, who work for NOAA, especially in crisis situations, especially when we need up-to-the-minute, up-to-date information about who's going to be affected and who's most at risk.
And NOAA is, of course, under the Commerce Department. And in your opinion, do you think they've been more politicized than other federal scientific agencies because of that position? I mean, we know the Commerce Department has had its own issues, particularly in regard to the 2020 census, for example.
Well, it tends to be regulatory agencies, agencies that make decisions about companies that have the most politicization of science. And so what we're seeing now is more of this political interference in science when it doesn't fit the message that an administration wants to put forward. So you see at the U.S. Geological Survey, scientists being told that they can't speak to the press. You see them being having their scientific methods limited in how they can use science to understand more about climate change. And at Commerce Department, we've seen the same thing. You know, the National Weather Service doesn't make regulatory decisions, and so you would expect that there would be less political pressure on them. Certainly, the census question is kind of demonstrates a pattern of abuse of science and abuse of information. With regard to the census, we saw that the Commerce Secretary time and time again insisted that they were adding the citizenship question to the census for scientific reasons. That turned out not to be the case. And so hopefully there'll be a very thorough investigation into who was involved in ordering the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to repudiate its own scientists, and there'll be some accountability there.
Michael Oppenheimer, want to bring you in here. Do scientists in federal agencies have any protections from political interference?
It's very difficult. I mean, in theory, there are whistleblower laws, but this is a little bit of a different situation. And so there's a lot of discomfort among the scientific community, those working in government and those working out of government, about what this administration is really up to. This is not the first time that an administration has tried to fudge the facts. The two Bush administrations did it with regard to climate change as well, tried to interfere with scientists testifying before Congress, for instance, change documents that were coming out of the White House that were supposed to have the facts in them. But this is different. This is, for instance, to give an extreme example, as if the Center for Disease Control decided to declare an epidemic in a region because the president wanted to suppress voter turnout. Now, that's not the motivation here, but that's how far it can get. We need to stay way away from that. And right now, the scientific community is very nervous about this administration.
Let's talk about that, because I'm wondering if this has had some sort of a chilling effect, particularly in federal agencies among scientists who are just trying to do their work and publish what's deemed impartial information.
I can tell you anecdotally, I'm on the board of an organization called the Climate Science Legal Defense Fund, which provides legal advice and just help and counsel to scientists who think they're under pressure by the government, for instance. And in this administration, there's been a huge uptake in people coming to the organization and asking for help, asking for legal advice or legal counsel. That's the kind of thing that didn't happen on a grand scale in the previous administration, and it's a direct measure of the discomfort and fear that many scientists have. Science needs to be independent. This administration is trying to get in the middle and muddle the facts.
I want to talk a little bit about how previous administrations have dealt with this in just a second. Michael Halpern, I'm going to bring you back in here because NOAA's acting chief scientist said he's going to investigate the controversy for potential violations of policies. What does that mean? And is this actually going to be an investigation that has any teeth here?
Yeah, so during the Obama administration, a lot of different scientific agencies set up what were called scientific integrity policies that were supposed to guarantee the rights of scientists to be able to speak publicly about their work without being censored, and to be able to publish research and the like. And NOAA does have a strong scientific integrity policy, and we'll see what comes of this particular investigation. The challenge is that this extends well beyond NOAA. We know that the Secretary of Commerce was involved, perhaps the White House, and we'll have to. There's no way that a scientist within NOAA is going to be able to determine so far up the food chain who had influence over this process and who should be held accountable. The other challenge here is that these scientific integrity policies are subject to the whims of the administrators, of the people who are at the top. And so scientists who operate under them can only push so far, lest those policies be rescinded, and they don't really have terribly meaningful protections should the decision go against them. I want to get back to the idea of censorship and self-censorship and whether or not scientists are feeling the heat. Certainly, the fact that a legal defense fund exists should tell you what kinds of pressures there are in climate scientists. But the Union of Concerned Scientists did surveys of scientists at a number of federal agencies in 2018, like we've done for the past 15 years, and found significant levels of political influence on and political pressure on the work of scientists and climate scientists in particular. And they poured out their hearts in essay responses to a number of questions. And at the National Park Service, for example, one scientist said that consistent removal of references to climate change have hindered the ability to have honest discussions about the threats associated with climate change to the national park system. We have to be able to have these conversations honestly and openly, and right now that's not happening.
Michael Oppenheimer, you mentioned George Bush's administration. I want to ask you even more broadly, have we seen past presidential administrations who have also used scientific agencies and reports for their own interests? And what I mean by that is, have we seen this kind of interference in the past, which really leads to bad information being relayed to the public?
Well, I think every administration of either party is tempted to do this and have probably done something at some scale, no matter who was president. The difference here is there's a complete lack of respect in this administration for science and the scientific process, and there's a complete lack of respect for those particular agencies, as Michael Halpern said, that is supposed to give us day-to-day data that protects our health and safety, like CDC, like the Weather Bureau. I mean, these are entities which our lives depend on, where we really need to hear the facts. No administration that I know of has gone that far.
Michael Halpern, are there any instances that really stand out to you in George W. Bush's administration or under President Barack Obama's administration that really interfered with the work of federal scientists?
Yeah, I mean, so under the Bush administration, we were able to chronicle a lot of examples of political interference in science. I remember Dick Cheney personally called a biologist to prevent the listing of an endangered species under the Endangered Species Act. So sometimes it goes all the way to the top. Under the Obama administration, we saw the president himself misrepresent science on emergency contraception and the EPA downplay the impact of fracking on drinking water. Certainly it happens in every administration, but we've been able to chronicle more than 100 abuses of science under the Trump administration, which is more than the 8 years under President George W. Bush. And what we're seeing now is it's not just censorship. They're moving entire, when there were economists at the USDA who came out with studies that Sonny Perdue didn't like, his decision was to move the USDA office all the way from Washington, D.C. to Kansas City. And he said at a fundraiser that his desire was to get these scientists to quit. They've ordered the National Academies of Science to stop work on studies on stream health and on offshore oil rig safety. And they've appointed people who are changing the rules to limit the types of science that can be used in making policy and the types of experts that can advise the government on scientific matters, from climate change to air pollution to toxic chemicals.
So, Michael Oppenheimer, I want to get your last thought here. What precedent will this latest NOAA scandal set for how we deal with scientific institutions in the future?
The best cure for this, after all, is the light of day. And I think it's terrific that the media are giving a lot of attention to it. What caused the Bush 1 administration to back off from inhibiting the testimony of James Hansen on climate change was the public outcry. What kept them from doing the same thing in the second Bush administration was public outcry. It's that embarrassment that the public does not want the government interfering with the facts that they need. And so the more the media and the public talks about this, the less chance there is it'll happen in the future.
Michael Oppenheimer is the director of the Center for Policy Research on Energy and the Environment at Princeton University. And Michael Halpern is the deputy director for the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On Monday, The Takeaway kicked off a conversation about consumer privacy online. And our discussion covered the ways in which banks and credit card companies routinely sell our personal data to all sorts of third-party brokers. And while this is all technically legal, Washington Post tech columnist Jeffrey Fowler mentioned some new legislation in California that could bring meaningful reform.
The state has what's called the Consumer Privacy Act, which is going to go into effect in January. And it's going to require a couple of things that are essentially going to become the toughest and de facto privacy law for the United States.
The California Consumer Privacy Act sets out to fundamentally alter the ways that tech companies collect data from internet users in the state. The Takeaway spoke with Haley Skayama, a legislative activist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which has been involved in crafting and defending this legislation.
It establishes four basic rights that are very important for all consumers: the right to know what information companies have collected about them, the right to request to delete that information, the right to opt out of the sale of that information, and the right to not be discriminated against for exercising any of those other rights, so that if somebody says, look, I want you to delete this information, that their company cannot then say, okay, well, if we do that, then you'll have to pay a little bit more.
Like many tech companies, Google tailors the ads you see online based on the data they collect about you. Google's parent company, Alphabet, earns 85% of its revenue from Google's ad business.
I certainly believe that companies have found a way of business that works for them, but this way of doing business does not work for consumers. I think you're seeing again and again people saying that they want to have stronger laws to protect their privacy.
And of course, tech companies are pushing back against that thinking by trying to amend the law.
What we're talking about is a poorly drafted law that was very quickly passed last year with very little input from stakeholders in about a week.
That's Tanya Forscheid, a partner and chair of the Privacy and Data Security Group at the law firm Frankfurt, Kernit, Klein and Sells in Los Angeles. And she says the CCPA would disrupt the advertising business model tech companies rely on, and that some consumers actually like targeted ads.
The law in its current form is unworkable for a variety of reasons. The first is that small and medium-sized businesses, and also possibly some larger businesses, simply won't comply. And they can't afford to hire lawyers to help them. They're not going to comply. If they do get caught in noncompliance, they will likely be put out of business because of the significant fines that can be assessed against them by the attorney general and possibly also through private litigation if they have a data breach. That's not good for consumers, obviously. Some consumers actually like to get relevant advertising and others don't find it that concerning. But if there's a mass opt-out, first of all, they're still going to get ads online. They'll just get ads for something like Viagra, which they don't want and which is annoying, as opposed to ads for, say, a deal on a car that they're interested in purchasing.
But Haley Skayama from the EFF doesn't agree that small businesses would bear the brunt of this bill.
So while I agree the California Consumer Privacy Act is not a perfect law, we have made sure that companies that are small or that are not primarily involved in the selling of data are not unnecessarily affected by it. To be a business under the California Consumer Privacy Act, you have to have annual gross revenues of more than $25 million, or the bulk of your revenue has to come from buying or selling data. And so there are very specific ways that we have cabined in sort of what businesses have to comply with the consumer requests. I think we have definitely seen companies in the past have to change their business practices to deal with consumer demands, to improve consumer protection. And also, this is a very innovative industry. We've already seen privacy protective businesses pop up, such as DuckDuckGo. Yes, it may change the way that people do business, but in a way that is better for consumers.
What's happening at the 11th hour are industries are seeking exemptions or clarifications to ensure that they can continue to operate status quo.
That's Kartike Mehrotra, a cybersecurity reporter at Bloomberg.
And that's sort of the point of the California Consumer Privacy Act, is to ensure that consumers who do not want their data being distributed or publicized without their consent can opt out of doing so. We'll have clarity in the next couple of days of exactly which industries might get a loophole or not.
Kartike says there's a lot riding on the outcome of this back and forth, and not just for Californians.
Not only will this shape the way that California consumers use the internet, but other states are paying attention as well. Whatever happens in California will likely be a benchmark for these states to come up with their own laws.
So I asked him to give us some more details about the lobbying push we're seeing as we approach the end of California's legislative session and why it's so significant.
The bills that we've learned the most about involve the ad tech industry. These are the companies that advertise to you on the internet. So when you go shopping on Amazon and pick out a pair of boots but don't press buy right away and go to Bloomberg.com, you may see those ads being advertised as you scroll down a story. And the company that benefits the most from this sort of targeted advertising is Google. And we have heard from sources in the corridors of the Sacramento Capitol that Google lobbyists are seeking an exemption to allow themselves to continue to advertise and use the data that they collect while advertising to sell or distribute to third parties that would find it interesting.
So that basically would take the power out of the hands of the internet user, right? So in other words, I would not be allowed to opt out if Google got its way?
There's a bit of a mystery in the 11th hour in terms of exactly how the language would be structured if it got through. There are two potential options. One, if you opt out of asking Google to not disseminate your data, in certain ways, it may still be distributed. It may be anonymized in ways, or potentially your direct identifiable information wouldn't be distributed. Another potential outcome could be separate legislation that would require you to opt out specifically for targeted advertising. So you may opt out of a different sorts of data aggregation, but you would have to do it again for targeted advertising specifically. I think it's probably prudent to say that right now it's unlikely that any of the measures that have been proposed by Google or the advertising industry are likely to push forward before the end of the week.
The bill itself has bipartisan support from what we understand. So, I mean, you just said it's pretty unlikely that that either of these amendments would actually make it into the final version. So who is big tech hoping to convince here?
This is Sacramento. This is the backyard of Silicon Valley, right? There are lawmakers who have, you know, benefited generously from the donations of tech industry and the advertising industry in California. So there are certainly allies who wish to ensure that the tech industry continues to boom, that the economy continues to grow. Google generates almost 85% of its revenue from advertising, and there are lawmakers who believe that that has strengthened the state's economy. And there's a reason why California is the fifth largest. So there are lawmakers who want to see this go through, but they're few and far between. What we're finding is that there are very few who are really willing to carry the water right now for the tech industry and make all this backlash over data aggregation.
I used to cover this industry a couple years ago, and at the time it was, a moneymaker. Is this really going to have an impact on Google's bottom line? I mean, doesn't Google have other forms of making money? And not just to single out Google here. I mean, is this going to hurt advertisers at the end of the day?
The biggest way this could impact advertisers may not be necessarily the way that you are targeted individually or what is done with your data. But what is interesting, and the thread that I'm most compelled by, is that when data is collected by a company like Google, they're not just turning around and using it to target you, but it's part of a broader landscape of data analysis to understand how user behavior is evolving and how to direct products at you down the line, and perhaps how to get a third party to pay for that data to advertise at you at a later date. And that's the kind of thing that could ultimately be affected if there is an outright opt-out of this sort of data. Again, Google depends on advertising for almost all of its revenue. 83%, I think, last quarter was their total composite figure. Any sort of impact on this central business model will have an effect.
So I want to pivot slightly. On Monday, we saw news that attorneys general in 50 states and territories are bringing an antitrust investigation against Google for manipulating its ad practices. And we've seen a similar investigation led by New York State Attorney General Letitia James against Facebook, for example. How does this play into our government's overall approach in regulating Silicon Valley? I mean, could this further weaken big tech's position in the fight over this California bill?
What it means, I think, is that there are attorneys around the country and entities with power who realize that the tech industry has a stranglehold on the way we interact with our devices, and that there needs to be some regulation and perhaps questions about whether some of these companies have gotten a little too big and are collecting too much information about us and have too much power. What the legislative wing of Washington does is wholly different from what lawmakers or attorneys general across states are considering. But there's certainly a correlation between the power that they're able to wield. And one way we may see that is in the lawmaking process in Washington in the years to come.
Kartikeya Mehrotra is a cybersecurity reporter at Bloomberg. Kartike, thanks for being with us.
Of course.
Okay, takeaway listeners. So I've been covering this topic for a while now. And almost a decade ago, news about targeted ads and companies tracking user browsing from site to site was already being reported. So when I was a reporter at the New York Times, I regularly wrote articles about the government's concern about consumer data and about the Federal Trade Commission's plans to protect user privacy. And here we are, 10 years later, and state governments are just now getting around to taking these questions seriously. So I have some questions. What else has Silicon Valley been up to in the meantime? And just how much are they profiting off of collecting and selling your online data? These are just some of the questions we're asking now, and we're going to continue to ask them in the months to come here on The Takeaway. Nearly one-third of all the food that's grown and packaged for human beings worldwide is either lost or wasted. And that's according to the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. And despite all that waste, about 10% of the global population still doesn't have enough to eat. Food waste is also a significant contributor to climate change. 8 to 10% of greenhouse gases in the world are connected to methane emissions created, get this, by rotting food. Here in the United States, 30 to 40% of our food supply is wasted, and that waste is the single largest contributor to American landfills. We asked you if you struggle with food waste and what you do to avoid it.
My name's Brenda. I'm from St. Helens, Oregon, and I hate wasting food. If I see food that is about to turn or needs to be used up, I will plan my dinners around it. The milk is going to turn. I make clam chowder. If the mushrooms are going bad, I make mushroom burgers. I hate wasting food.
Hi, Natalie Woodbury calling from Alamo, California. To reduce food waste, we keep a bin in the freezer, and once full, we tie it up, put it in the green bin alongside our yard clippings, and we're really thrilled that we can do that.
While there are many individual and state-level attempts to reduce food waste, some European countries are trying to address this problem in a big way at the national level, and the United States is lagging behind. Here to talk about why is Meredith Niles, assistant professor in the Nutrition and Food Sciences Department at the University of Vermont. Welcome to the show, Meredith.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we just mentioned the global numbers, but there are certain countries where this is happening more than others. Tell us where those are.
That's right. Well, when we look at food waste globally, what we see is that high-income countries like the United States and European countries actually waste about twice as much food as countries, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa. Interestingly, at the consumer level, it's about 10 times as much waste. So here in the United States and other European countries, we're really wasting a lot more food in our own households at the retail level as compared to on farms, for example.
Why is there so much consumer food waste? I mean, is it just that we're throwing things away because we don't want to finish them? We can't finish them? What's happening here?
I think there's a lot of complex reasons behind this. For example, in the United States, we know, first of all, that food is very cheap. It's affordable. That's great for some reasons, but it could also be contributing to food waste. So we spend about 6% of our household income on food in the United States. By comparison, in Kenya, they spend about 50% of their household income on food. So cheaper food means that it's, you know, very abundant and very affordable. And then we also have some structural issues, I think, in the United States around laws and policies that make it more challenging to understand when food, for example, has really gone bad.
Is that the sell-by date? I mean, I know a lot of us probably make decisions to toss food based on that date, if the milk is about to go bad, like one of our callers mentioned. Is that always accurate? And how does that impact the amount of food that's wasted here?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's actually no federal standard for what those dates really mean or what they have to look like. So you might look at one food item and see sell by. Another food item might say use by or best by. And there's a lot of terminology out there. And there's no standardized system for what that terminology really needs to mean. And those dates are set by the manufacturer. Typically, those dates are more about quality as opposed to the food truly being rotten or going bad. So here in the United States, there's actually some bipartisan legislation in Congress right now introduced by Representative Pingree from Maine and Representative from Washington State that would actually create a federal standard to standardize those things. And studies have shown that this is really confusing to consumers. You know, we don't know what all those different dates mean. And we often try to, you know, play it safe. We don't want to necessarily eat something that's gone bad. But there's also really no standard way of knowing what has gone bad in the current system.
There also isn't a lot of just general communication on food waste. I mean, some of the numbers we set out at the top of the show were new to me, and I'm sure to many of our listeners. Are there any federal initiatives to reduce the amount of food waste in the United States?
So in 2015 in the United States, the Department of Agriculture and the Environmental Protection Agency came out with a goal to reduce U.S. food waste 50% by 2030. Now, that goal is in line with United Nations Sustainable Development Goal around food waste, but that's really just at an agency level right now. There's no federal legislation that's trying to achieve this. The agencies are funding research and doing some agency-level efforts, but really we're not seeing strong effort at the federal level. What's different, for example, in the European Union is they have the same goal also to have food waste by 2030, but they actually passed legislation in 2018 that requires national plans and reporting on the amount of food waste that is happening beginning in 2020. So we are seeing some federal efforts here in the United States, but not as much as what we're seeing happening from the European Union, for example.
You mentioned that food is cheap in this country, and I mean, obviously, that depends on who we're talking about. But I think about the sort of big box stores that sell us like massive amounts of food for really cheap prices here. Does that contribute to this as well? Like being able to go to Costco and buy, you know, 25 bananas instead of two?
Well, I think that's, you know, potentially part of the problem. You know, one thing that's happening in the United States that's changed in recent years, we're spending more and more of our food dollars away from the home. We're eating out more. We're getting more takeout. So I think we have to think about this problem in two ways. First of all, we need to think about what we do in our own households and how we might reduce food waste in our own households. But we also need to involve grocery stores and retailers and restaurants in their efforts as well to reduce food waste, because we're actually spending just about as much money on food outside of the home as we are inside the home as well.
There seems to be a disconnect between the amount of food that we waste in the United States and the percentage of Americans who don't have enough to eat. How do we close that gap?
Well, we certainly know that these are dual problems, right? We have food waste, but we also know that about 12% of the population is classified as food insecure here in the United States. And some of the efforts to reduce food waste are directly helping to alleviate that problem. So food donations that major grocery stores and retailers can make to food pantries and food shelves are really helping provide more food for people directly. But I will say that the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, has a hierarchy for food waste. And the first thing that they want to do is let's reduce food waste first. And then second, if we have it, let's provide it for people when it's appropriate and safe.
Are there any initiatives that are happening across the world that you think the U.S. would be smart to adopt?
Well, in France, there was a law that passed a few years ago that there actually is no waste allowed to come out of supermarkets anymore. So supermarkets sometimes will throw away perfectly edible food because it doesn't look right. And, you know, you walk into a grocery store and everything looks beautiful. Well, that's not because all of that produce has always looked beautiful. It's because some perfectly edible food has maybe not been put on the shelves. So in France, in fact, that law requires that supermarkets must donate that food, for example. And I think that's a really, really great effort. We also know there's other things happening here in the United States at the state level, which I think we could also look towards. For example, in Vermont, where I live, we do have a universal recycling law that's working on helping provide compost systems for residents, for example, to divert some of their food waste.
So other than buying ugly food, which is something I know we've seen campaigns for here in New York, are there other things that individual consumers can do to make a dent?
There's actually some great technology out there and some really nice apps that are being developed to help people better manage these systems. You know, it's complex, right? We're all rushing to make dinner at the 5:30 hour and we're not sure what we're going to make and we're going to the grocery store and buying things quickly. One that I have on my phone is called Kitchen Pal. It actually lets you put in what you have in your fridge right now and gives you recipes. So helping you use up those kinds of things that you've already got in your fridge and making the most of those to try to prevent food waste.
Meredith Niles is an assistant professor at the University of Vermont. Meredith, thanks for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.